Well, good morning. So let me start briefly reviewing what we have done 2 days ago. And so what is amazing about this ADS CFT is that it not only allows you to calculate local operators, like correlation functions and stuff like that, by simple gravitational calculations, but it also allows you to study some non-local operators. And so an example of non-local operator will be the Wilson loop, which is a non-local gauge invariant operator, which is given by the exponential of the circular integral over the gauge field A mu, right? And so now there's a proposal how to calculate these objects on the gravity side. And the proposal is very simple. So you do the circular integral over some closed loop. So that's your closed loop here. That closed loop actually lives on the boundary of your ADS space. And then what you do is that you hang the string from this closed loop into the bulk, such that the sigma is the corresponding worksheet of that string. And that worksheet has to end on that closed loop. So this is this condition here. But then all you have to do is that in order to calculate the expectation value of this Wilson loop is actually to study this classical string which hangs into that. And of course, the equations of motion for the classical string are given by the classical Nambu-Goto action, which is evaluated on the classical solution. So you have to extremize the Nambu-Goto action. That's what gives you the classical motion. And so that's how you calculate these Wilson loops over here. And so this is just a reminder that how the Nambu-Goto action looks like. And all you have to do is that you have to calculate what is the induced metric on the worksheet sigma, gamma AB. And then you calculate this determinant. And that's what gives you this Nambu-Goto action here. So in particular, we were interested in this specific contour, which goes in time in one direction. And then it's the rectangular contour and then r in the spatial direction. And what you can think about it is that at this initial time t, you create a quark-antiquark pair. You take it apart to the distance r. Then you let the quarks be. They still simply sit there and interact with each other. And then after some long time, you annihilate them again. And so that's what that contour basically means. So now for that contour, you can easily argue that this expectation value of this Wilson loop has to be of the form e to minus t times v, where v is the potential between the quarks. And by comparing this thing here with your ADS CFT prescription, you find that you can find the potential between the quarks by simply evaluating the Nambu-Goto action and divided by t. Okay, so now why this is interesting is that you can have two phases. You can have the unconfined phase where the quarks where the potential between the quarks goes like 1/r, or you can have the confined phase where it drastically changes and suddenly it's proportional to r. So it's like completely different phase. And the question is, can you recover this behavior from the ADS CFT correspondence? And so what I tried to argue last lecture is that, well, okay, so we have to calculate this contour here. We take t equal to constant slice like that. And so then you get a picture where you have the string at that t equal to constant slice. The string is hanging like this from your boundary. And you calculated this exactly in your tutorial, but I sort of try to argue that, well, this almost looks like a rectangle. And so if you have rectangle, you have these contributions, which, however, they tell you only about the quark mass. Anyway, you had to subtract this in your calculation, in the exact calculation, these pieces here anyway, because they correspond to rest energy or something like that. And then that, of course, is infinite. So you have to subtract these things here. But then what really describes your potential is this piece here of the loop. And again, what I tried to argue last time is that, if you make the quarks more separated, if r is getting bigger and bigger, this string will actually go deeper and deeper in the bulk, which comes from the metric Basically, you know that in the metric, the dz square has the same appearance as dx square. And so this is reasonable. But again, that's something which you've shown in your tutorial, and you calculated exactly the proportionality constant, which was, I don't know, remember, 0.5 or something like that. So you found that z0 is 0.5r. But Saturn is proportional to r. Okay, so that's the argument. So now, in order to calculate the contribution of this thing here, you really need to evaluate the number of Gotto action for this piece of the string. But this is our induced metric. So if you have the full metric in Poincaré coordinates, there will be also dy square and dz square. But of course, dz square for this piece of the metric is 0. Dy square is 0. So it's just this piece over here. And that's our two-dimensional metric induced on the worksheet of this string. And so then the square root of determinant of gamma AB, so determinant is L square over Z square for each piece, but then you're taking square root, so it's L square over Z square, L square over Z square. And then if you evaluate this Nambu-Goto action, this Nambu-Goto action goes like 1 over 2 pi alpha prime, and then it will be d tau dx and L square over Z square. Okay, and so for our counter, d tau just gives us t. Nothing, you know, depends on t. So this thing here will give us 1 over alpha prime. Integral over d tau gives you t. Now this is L square over z square, but z square is z zero square, and dx just gives us r. Okay, so that's what it is. But we argue that z0 is proportional to r square. So this thing here goes like L square. Alpha prime is LS square. And then T over R, like that, right? Because z0 is proportional to R. And so this gives you square root of 2 lambda. So this is square root of 2 lambda T over R. And now if you compare with how you calculate the potential, you just simply divide by T. And that gives you that the potential is really the unconfined potential here. Okay, so from here we have unconfined potential V, which goes like square root of 2 lambda divided by R. Okay, so that's the calculation we have done last time. And so we can very well describe the unconfined phase just hanging the string in ADS space. Okay, so now the question is, can we get by similar argument also the confined phase? Okay, so what about the confined phase? Okay, and so confined phase you cannot get really in the Super-Young Mills, and the reason is that you don't have the scale which would tell you at which scale you are starting to be confined. So you need to introduce another scale. So typically, the confined phase happens, you know, for small energies, right? So I need to introduce another scale into the thing, which will tell me what is the small energy when actually the confined phase happens, right? And so how you do that is that you simply introduce another scale. So instead of considering the pure ADS, you will consider pure ADS with some scale. And you can interpret that scale, for example, as that saying, well, I removed the origin of the ADS. And instead of going into the origin, I will go to some finite, I am allowed to go only to some finite distance. Let's call it, I don't know, what did I call it? ZC. OK, so introduce a new scale. Without that scale, we cannot have a confined phase, which means we are also departing from CFT. Okay, and that tells me how far, uh, how deep my string can go. Go in ADS. And so basically the picture is, okay, so if you have quarks which are, you know, closely separated, then our picture looks like this. And of course it doesn't know, so this thing here is pure ADS, but it doesn't know about anything. But if I start putting them more apart, so if I have quark like this, okay, and suddenly I say, well, there will be some cutoff here below which I cannot go. So there'll be some Z equal to Z cutoff below which I cannot go. I cannot go all the way to Z, it goes to infinity, but rather I can go only to a finite scale here. Then, of course, this guy would like to go all the way here, but it cannot. It just, you know, it has to end on this cutoff scale. Okay, so this is fixed. This is fixed. And so, you know, and then, you know, your string has to look like this. So there will be some critical distance. So here, VR will go like 1 over R because, you know, here the string doesn't know that there is a cutoff deep in the bulk. But there will be some critical radius, R, for which, you know, this string really hangs to this cutoff. And then below that, it cannot go deeper. So it would like to go deeper, but it cannot, right? Because I introduced this cutoff. Very good. So if I am, you know, the distance R is bigger than this critical, that will be R critical here. This one here will be the R critical. And for that R critical, there will be new behavior of the potential. So this potential will behave like something else. So let's see how it will behave, right? So again, all I have to do is to calculate, you know, this for this piece of the string, what is the potential, right? So again, I have to evaluate the Nambu-Goto action. So now your S Nambu-Goto goes still like 1 over alpha prime, and then d tau dx L square over Z square, L square over Z square. But at this point, if I reach this thing here and I go, like, I separate it even further away, I cannot go to Z proportional to R. The most I can do, I can go to Z equal to ZC. So in this case, this thing here will be ZC square. Okay, because I cannot go any deeper than that. Okay? And so you see that this is equal to, again, you have L square over LS square from here and from there. But now this is a constant. That's C square, that's fixed. And this gives me T, and this gives me R. Okay? So you suddenly find that the potential V of R is proportional to R. Yes?
What's the reason for this cutoff? Like, is there something that goes to infinity if it's not there?
So simply, you know, so the statement is you cannot have a confined phase if you have CFT. You need to have another scale. You need to introduce another scale into the problem so that you can have a phase transition between unconfined and confined phase, right? So the reason is you need to form some kind of, you need to compare scales. And if you have two scales, like you have ADS length, there's always one scale in the problem. But if that's the only length, I don't know where to do the phase transition, right? If I have another scale, I can form a dimensionless number, L over ZC, or something like that. And so then I know, like, if this is one, let's say, there will be a phase transition or something like that. So really you need a new scale. But it also, this all makes perfect sense. Look, so if I want to probe distances like this, very, very small distances, then I have high, I have high energies. If I want to probe small distances, I have high energies. On the other hand, if I want to probe large distances, I have small energies. So this thing here really corresponds to some small energy scale where the phase transition happens.
So the boundary is not CFT
So this is no longer CFT, but it's more realistic for your quark, gluon, plasma, or something like that, which is not CFT either, right? So this is more realistic physics, where you have some additional scales, you have, right? You have massive quarks and stuff like that. So you break CFT, so you're here departing from CFT, but it's more realistic physics. It's what we see in our universe.
But why is it called ADCFT?
That's a good question. So it's, people don't call it ADS-CFT anymore. That's why they call it gauge duality, right? So it's a gravity gauge duality, which is more general than ADS-CFT. Okay. So yes, you can get the confined phase, confined potential, by simply saying, well, I departure from pure ADS, I introduce a cutoff in my ADS, I introduce another scale, which will tell me about, you know, at which low energy the confinement phase can happen. Yes?
I'm not sure if this is Donjit's question, I didn't really understand, but so the cutoff isn't at all natural to ADS, there's no reason to put it in, like the specific cutoff, it's just kind of in both.
There's very many ways how you can do the cutoff, and so I don't want to go into details, but okay, let's not go into details. So the statement is, if I want a phase transition, if I want a confined phase, I need to have another scale. So remember, when you studied Hawking-Page phase transition, right? So that phase transition happened for spherical black holes. Spherical black holes have spherical horizon topology. What it means is that there is another characteristic scale which tells you how curved your horizon is, or how curved your... So you are now putting ADS, you are now putting CFT on a spherical boundary or something like that. And there is a characteristic curvature of the spherical boundary. So you know, what you did in your first homework and when we discussed the Hawking phase transition, we had another scale there already, which was the curvature of the of the horizon or something like that. So there it's very natural. Right. So for example, so here we are trying to pretend that we are planar, right? But if we are planar, we don't have that another scale, right? So we need to do it by hand, basically.
Does this work in global coordinates? You'd have another scale, right?
True and not true. Well, again, so you know, if I had global coordinates, you can still have planar black holes, but. It's a good point. Let me think about it. Okay, let's not say something stupid, which I would definitely say. So third, okay. So this is all at zero temperature, sort of, right? What if I say, well, I want really a plasma phase, which has plasma is at finite. I really want to describe quark gluon plasma at finite temperature. Okay, what about plasma phase? At finite temperature. At finite T. And so the statement is, okay, we will learn in a minute, just if you wait 10 minutes, we will get there. If you want CFT at finite temperature, you just put a black hole in the bulk. The black hole will have some temperature, Hawking temperature. This will be precisely the temperature of the CFT. Okay, so we now have a black hole, and so the picture which now looks like this. So again, you have your quark and antiquark, and then you would happily want to go in the bulk, but at some point you encounter a black hole here. So this thing here now will be a black hole. This is a black hole horizon. Black hole horizon. And let's see that, you know, there will be some, you know, again, for small separation, we will not know about this thing here, but for large, sufficiently large separation, we will reach the horizon of the black hole. And then what happens? So then the statement is that in that case, the metric gamma square on the worksheet looks precisely like what you have there, except now you have a black hole, you have the blackening factor, right? So you don't have Minkowski space, but you have in front of d tau square, you have your metric function f, which describes where the horizon is located. Okay, so in this case, d gamma square is l square over z square f d tau square plus dx square, okay? Where this f is the blackening factor. Which describes where the horizon is, right? So it's the standard metric function, as you know, for Schwarzschild or something like that. You will see it in a minute explicitly. But you know what is interesting about this thing here? So again, so now if you calculate the determinant, so now that gamma AB, okay, so there will be still L square over Z square, but there will be square root of F, right? So that's the difference between this case when we have a black hole and that case when we don't have a black hole. So now you want to evaluate it for the string which exactly touches the horizon. Okay, so we just extend and suddenly we meet the horizon. What happens with F when you on the horizon of the black hole? It's zero. So this is zero. On r equal to r plus, or whatever, z equal to z plus. Okay? What does it mean? If I repeat the calculation, my S Nambu-Goto action is zero. S Nambu-Goto is zero. And so the potential V of r is zero when I meet the black hole. Does it make sense at all or not? So I found that suddenly, if I have a plasma phase, I have a quark in plasma, another quark in plasma, then the potential between them will be zero. Is it physical?
I don't know that much about plasmas.
Sorry?
I don't know that much about plasmas.
Okay. But it's something where, you know, things are free to move. Basically, that's what you need to know, right? So if I have, I don't know, a proton, so you have lots of, let's say, protons, lots of, well, nomoplasma, lots of protons, lots of electrons, whatever, everything is free to move, right? What happens if I have the proton here? The electrons actually move close to it, right? And so what they do is that they shield the electromagnetic force of the proton, right? So we have a shielding in plasma, right? So this is called Debye screening. This is precisely what happens. So actually, if you have free plasma at finite temperature, all the charges are screened, and you don't really see any interaction between the two things if the two things are sufficiently far separated. OK, so this corresponds to Debye screening. And so really, there is no force in between the plasmas, in between the quarks, because there is the screening here. So it all makes perfect sense. By the way, what people also study is that they study the moving quarks, right? If you So what people do, right? You have the Large Hadron Collider, and they smash the protons together, and then you create a soup of quark-gluon plasma, right? And the soup typically, you know, just particles like escape from the collision, right? They start escaping from the collision, so the quarks will really be moving. So now, what you know, in order to describe realistic plasma, this quark will be moving this direction, and the quark will be moving that direction, and then you may be studying what's happening. Where, you know, what kind of energy transfer is there? So now we are in plasma phase. So you have the string which sort of, you know, hangs here, but it goes to the black hole, right? And so there will be an energy transfer to the black hole, which corresponds to the fact that if you move things through the plasma, there is a dissipation of energy. And so the things actually lose energy pretty quickly because there's an energy transfer to the black hole in the dual picture. Okay, so people are still playing with these Wilson loops here. Question, yes?
I think in plasma physics, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it has some scale because it's exponential decay. So I think it has some characteristic scale. Is there any correspondence in this model, like any scale that corresponds to Debye screening scale?
I guess in this, So certainly the screening does not happen here. Right, so in this case, it just so you have to really reach this thing here. So this will happen precisely for the scale which is determined by this at plus, right? So I think that will be the scale for which really you start seeing this complete scale screening, right? I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah, but certainly these guys, they don't see it, right? So these guys, they are happy, and the potential goes like 1/r or something like that, right? So you know, what I want you to do is that I want you to connect these pictures, what we are doing with the Wilson loops, with whatever you have learned about the Hawking page phase transition, right? And in the Hawking page phase transition, you learn something like this. You learn that here, there will be the black hole phase, which corresponds to the plasma phase. Plasma phase. And here, there will be the radiation phase, which is the confined phase. So there's a radiation phase here, and there's a confined phase. So try to map, you know, whatever I'm telling you here about the Wilson loops to whatever you already know about the Hawking phase-phase transition, and you know, that black holes correspond to plasma phase. Okay, try to map that to here. Okay. New topic, CFT at finite temperature. I believe it's also a phase transition, a quantum phase transition. It must be, right? I mean, if you have quark gluon phase transition, I think it's a definite quantum, right? Very quantum. You are talking about strongly coupled quantum field theory, right? So your quark gluon plasma very strongly coupled QFT, right? And so it's very, very quantum, right? Okay, so now remember, so far we are discussing sort of, except this last blackboard, we were discussing t equal to zero CFT, right? ADS CFT correspondence. And so when we were trying to motivate this ADS CFT with the stack of brains and we compared it to the extremal D3 brain solution, the type 2B supergravity solution, which was extremal, had zero temperature, right? But then I actually wrote down a solution which was slightly more general and which had a finite temperature. So recall from a couple lectures before that we have the non-extremal black brain solution. Brain solution of type 2B supergravity. And then if you look at the nodes, the solution looked like this thing here. DS10² was, this is the same thing, but now there was this blackening factor, FdT², dx², dy², dz². Okay, so that's this piece, and then there's this other piece, h½, dr² over f, plus r² d omega 5², okay? So this is the solution which we've seen already, and you can think about it like really Reisner and Nordstrom solution, but now not necessarily extreme, not necessarily m equal to q, okay? So this thing here has h, which is 1 plus l to the 4 r to the 4, and then f is 1 minus r0 to the 4 r to the 4. This f describes where the horizon, the other horizon is located. So it will be at r equal to r0. So we have sort of like one horizon. So this describes the horizon at r equal to r0. But there will be another horizon at r equal to 0. So you have now two horizons corresponding to non-extremal Reisner Nordstrom solution. You have inner horizon, you have outer horizon. Here, the inner horizon is at r equal to 0. The outer horizon is at r equal to r0. Okay, so that's the solution here. And then when we wanted to compare with the open string picture with, you know, these strings ending on the brain and stuff like that, we went to the near horizon geometry, right? So we did the near horizon limit of this thing here. So near, let's do the same thing. Near horizon limit. But what you want to do is that you want to send r much, much smaller than l, right? So that's what we have done when we are doing the near horizon limit. Then, but we also want to preserve this horizon at r equal to 0. So what we will be really doing is that we look at the region where R0 is smaller than R is much, much smaller than L. Okay, so we want to do this type of limit. So we are really, really close to the horizon, but we are still above that horizon. Okay, which means that F sort of remains unchanged. Remains unchanged. Sort of. Okay. So anyway, so what it means is that I still just do the expansion. L is much, much bigger than R. So H, in this case, goes like L to the 4 divided by R to the 4. So we have, from this metric, that ds squared is approximately equal to R squared divided by L squared, whatever we are doing here. But we are keeping this f, dt squared plus dx squared plus dz squared. And then plus L squared over R squared dr squared over f plus R squared d omega 5 square. Okay, so that's the limit we weren't doing before. And then if you want, you can still do this rescaling that you set z equals to L squared over R, as we did before. And you group this term with the rest here, and you put the sphere on its own. So what you get from here is ds squared is equals to L squared over z squared minus f dt squared plus dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. What did I do? It's a different z. Disaster. dx1 squared, dx2 squared, dx3 squared. Sorry for that. X1, x3. This will be the z. Sorry for that. Okay, right? So this thing here will be that. So it's dx squared, dx2 squared, dx3 squared, plus dz squared. Okay? Yeah, that's fine. And then plus L squared d omega 5 squared. Okay? So now, again, what we have, as before, is the S5, its radius L. L. But here, this thing here, because we have this non-trivial F now here, there will be a black hole. The ADS5 black hole. So this guy here is an ADS5. But look at this. So what the horizon looks like at z equal to something, it looks like that, and then I'm missing. Am I missing f, right? F here. Sorry for that. There's an f here. So this will be the ADS black hole. But if z is equal to constant, if you are on the horizon, and let's say you don't care about time, then the topology of that horizon is a plane. So this is a planar ADS black hole. ADS 5 planar black hole. So really, if you are looking at that horizon, it looks like a plane. It looks like a sheet, right? So, and this is allowed in ADS for some reason. So in ADS, you can have spherical black holes, or you can have planar black holes, or you have hyperbolic black holes. You have all kinds of things. If asymptotically flat, you just have spherical black holes. There's nothing else. Yes?
What happens if you approach it, if you approach the singularity from the horizon from the perpendicular direction to the plane?
So this is the horizon, right? So you always have to approach it in this direction, right? You can move it in the horizon, sort of, but. Right?
The horizon is a finite.
So there will be a singularity underneath still. There'll still be a singularity, but really the horizon looks like a plane. So, or you know, you can think about Rindler horizon or something like that, right? So that also has different topology than sphere, right? But it's not really a real horizon. It's just an acceleration horizon, which you can remove by right. But think about it like a different kind of horizon, which has different topology. But this is a real black hole because there is still a singularity, well, which is shielded by this horizon. I don't know that. Okay, so very good. So this is precisely the solution I used here, right? So we were not doing anything with Z, so there was no Z, but we had this F thing here, and so F dt square, and then that was the remaining thing here. So we have a planar black hole, and the statement is this precisely, you know, the properties of this black hole map one-to-one to the properties of the CFT at finite temperature on the boundary. So properties of black hole, so we have, you know, ADS5 black hole and cross S5. So now the properties of this black hole, properties of this black hole determine properties of the CFT. You will study these in your tutorial today, so you will see explicitly how everything maps together. But in particular, let me just mention this. So specifically, the black hole temperature, the Hawking temperature, gives you know, the temperature of the CFT. Okay. So now, if you calculate that, and you will do it in your tutorial, but I'm spoiling it, you will find that this is 1 over pi z 0, where I didn't write what this f is. So this f is, of course, transformation of that, but you can write it as 1 minus z over z 0 to power 4. Okay. So at z equal to z 0, or I call it z plus, there will be a horizon. Okay, this f will be 0. So where f of z 0 equals to 0. Okay. So this is the temperature of the CFT. So now, confusing remark. Okay, very confusing remark. Very, very something. So this is really the CFT. But you have already seen CFT. You know that in CFT at finite temperature, there's only one dimensionful quantity, temperature. It's nothing else than that, right? There cannot be any phase transition. There can be anything interesting because it's just one dimensionful thing. It's the temperature, okay? So now, to confuse you even more, what happens with that metric, which I just wrote down there, if I do some weird rescaling? So beware. What if I do a scaling x mu? So this xi, whatever, vx mu goes to lambda x mu, and then z goes to lambda z. And here I x mu includes also time. And z0 goes to lambda z0. Okay, what happens with the function f if I do z goes to lambda z and z0 goes to lambda z0? It remains the same. What happens with this part here? So f remains the same.
The other part scale.
Sorry?
The dx1, dx2, dx3, that scales, is it
not? Uh-huh, so that will scale like lambda square, right? But then I have a z square here. So that will also scale like lambda square. So this thing remains invariant, okay?
Then that also applies to the dz over f. Oh, okay, no, that's too, wait.
That's a
mute.
Huh? So this is a symmetry. Symmetry.
Like it equals t also.
Of metric. Okay. But if this is a symmetry of the metric, it should not be observable. Okay, but look what happens with my temperature here. The temperature now goes like, well, if I scale the, like, temperature over lambda, right? Okay, the temperature changes. What does it mean? It means that the temperature really doesn't mean anything. Okay? It means that all the temperatures here, it's CFT. All the temperatures here are equivalent. There's no any other scale to tell me how to distinguish 100 degrees from 1 degree. So all temperatures are equivalent. Unless another scale is introduced. But if you introduce another scale, you break CFT. So what it means, they are equivalent apart from zero, right? If you start with zero temperature, it's different than any other temperature. But then if you have non-trivial temperature, all the temperatures are equivalent. It's CFT, right? But if I introduce another scale, yes, I can suddenly start talking about the meaning of the temperature. I can start talking about phase transitions and stuff like that. If you have non-planar black hole here, you have the spherical one, as we studied. We have Hawking-Page transition because there is this extra radius. There's an extra scale. I broke the invariance already, the conformal symmetry of the thing. And so in that case, the temperatures are not equivalent. But here, in the planar case, I have no any other scale, and everything is sort of equivalent. Okay, so that's the property of the CFT. Yes?
I should have asked this earlier, but when we say temperature of the CFT, do we mean correlation functions are computed with that temperature value and the path integral? And the Euclidean path integral? Is that the meaning?
Sounds good to me, yeah, for example.
What about the radiation? Is this black hole also radiates the?
Okay, so these things will still produce the, so this is a normal black hole, right? So it will have Hawking radiation at that given temperature, whatever that means, right? And yeah, so there will be a radiation surrounding the black hole.
But there is still, even though there's any other scale, and it's still a CFT, there is still a phase transition at t equals zero, right?
Okay, so yeah, so t equals zero can be different. Right, so t equal to zero is different, and so that's what we have seen here. So, for example, if we introduce another scale here, like the cutoff for the ZC, so this is at t equal to zero, right? We can have a phase transition, but you need another scale for phase transitions and stuff like that. So, anyway, so just have this in mind when you know somebody tells you, yeah, this is a given temperature of that. So not quite, right? Very good. So now you will study everything. So you'll study all the other properties. You will calculate what is the entropy of the CFT from the black hole calculation. You will calculate what the free energy is and stuff like that. And you will compare that to whatever you have done in your dimensional analysis yesterday. Okay. So you will understand all the properties of the CFT at finite temperature by just studying this black hole spacetime over here. Okay. So now the most interesting topic, which really, you know, some people thought, well, this is interesting, but we don't really care for particle physics and stuff like that, right? But there is one calculation people have done in the ADS-CFT correspondence, which really, you know, people said, wow. So if this is true, then actually we should be interested in ADS-CFT. What that calculation is the calculation of the shear viscosity of quark-gluon plasma. Okay, so let me just start here, and I will not really drive you through the calculation, but I will give you what the recipe is, what needs to be done. Okay, so let me mention this thing here is a calculation of the shear viscosity of quark gluon plasma. Okay, and that's something which really, you know, when people calculated this for the first time, everybody was so excited about, right? And so, first of all, what is quark gluon plasma? You smash two protons in the Large Hadron Collider, and you create this soup of the particles where you have to, you know, unconfined quarks and stuff like that. And it looks, you know, it's a very strongly coupled, so quark-gluon plasma is a strongly coupled strongly coupled soup of many particles, right? Okay, and so when people done the experiment at LHC, they found that this sort of behaves, it's very well described by you know, it looks like a liquid, right? Sort of, it looks, it can be described by hydrodynamics. Well described by hydrodynamics. Okay, and so there's one property which is, I'll do it in, let me just give you a very rough idea what shear viscosity is, right? So let's say you have your liquid, you have honey, right? And then you start moving something in the honey. Let's say I start moving my finger in the honey. But this is, because there's this non-trivial viscosity, my motion will induce the motion of surrounding honey. And so then, you know, things will start moving in that direction. So what is shear viscosity? Shear viscosity is something like, well, I have something, my finger or something like that, which moves with velocity v, right? So that's a moving finger or moving, I don't know, what you can move in the honey. It's like that. And let's say this is in the x direction and this will be in the y direction. So then what happens because of the viscosity, you know that there will be a motion of the honey here. And of course, the motion will eventually die as you are going further and further away from that object which you are moving. Okay, so in other words, there will be, you know, this motion induced, and this is proportional to the shear viscosity coefficient. Shear viscosity coefficient, and it depends on, you know, how far this is decaying, it corresponds to the gradient of this velocity in the x direction, right? So this is what the shear viscosity really describes. Okay, so it's a coefficient standing in front of this thing, and you know how quickly my velocity, which is tracked along my moving finger, actually dies in this y direction. So that's what the shear viscosity is. Okay, and so then people were able to measure this shear viscosity for the quark-gluon plasma created in Large Hadron Collider. And what they found, well, the shear viscosity is actually, so they were able to determine and measure this eta coefficient here. Okay? And it's huge because the temperature of the plasma is huge. But some clever people said, well, okay, why don't I take two huge things, entropy and shear viscosity? They both depend on the temperature of the plasma. In the same way, they depend like T cube, and so let's divide them. Okay, so then there is this shear viscosity versus entropy ratio. There is a ratio, which is shear viscosity divided by the density of entropy. Okay, and then they found that this is extremely small. Okay, they found this is extremely small. Okay, and so at that point, people doing ADS-CFT, they did the gravity calculation of this shear viscosity thing. And we will sort of do it, I will give you the recipe how to do it. And what they found is that they found that eta over s in the ADS-CFT calculation should be given 1 over 4 pi. Okay, so that's the prediction of the ADS-CFT. Okay, so now what is really measured? So now I say extremely small. What is really measured is that eta over s is 1 over 4 pi, and then something between 1 and 2.5 times 1 over 4 pi. Okay, so this is what people really measured. And so it's very, very close to this ADS-CFT result. Okay, why is this remarkable? Because if you take anything else then quark-gluon plasma, then a strongly coupled plasma, which we know to exist in our universe, if you take water, which is not strongly coupled. So compare this to water. Compare for water. This is about 10 to 1,000 times bigger than this. And if you take many other, you know, normal liquids or whatever, this shear viscosity ratio will be much, much bigger than this 1 over 4 pi. But because these all these things are weakly coupled, okay? So now the, you know, one of the strongly coupled things which we know is precisely this quark-gluon plasma. That's what should be described by a weak gravity dual. Okay, you have strong weak coupling, you have strongly coupled CFT, that corresponds to weak coupling on gravity calculation. That's what gives you 1 over 4 pi. So, you know, what it basically, so then what people conjectured is that, of course, if you have ideal fluid, right, if you have ideal fluid, the shear viscosity is zero, right? There's no shear viscosity in ideal fluid. In any other real fluid, in real fluid, the shear viscosity will be non-zero. But this is the smallest value you can get of eta over s. In some sense, the quark-gluon plasma is conjectured to be like the most ideal fluid you can get in real nature. So this is like the most ideal fluid. Okay. Yes.
I'm trying to understand the competition, like the competition between the shear viscosity and the entropy.
Yeah.
So when it's very small, when it's an ideal fluid, the shear viscosity is near zero, is the statement. But for water, for example, it's very big. I guess I'm struggling to understand what's the connection between the viscosity and the entropy.
So you know, if you do the calculation, you will find that both these quantities that depend on the temperature of the fluid you are thinking about or whatever, right? And so you can show that both these quantities, they behave like T cube, I believe, right? So in fact, you know, because you create your quark-gluon plasma at very, very large temperatures, the shear viscosity will still be large, but so will be the entropy. Okay, and so suddenly, you know, if you start comparing these two, then what stands in front of T cube for the shear viscosity is really, really small, right, when compared to what stands in front of the entropy. So what would be the physical meaning of this ratio? Think about it. Let's discuss it maybe in the tutorial, what it could be. Yeah.
I had another question about it as well. So the idea of CFT calculation would be gravity equals, like on the gravitation, the calculation is done on the gravitational side, but the dual of that is n equals 4?
Well, it will be done on the gravitational side with a black hole. So we will have like a plasma at finite temperature, right?
Yeah, but this quark-gluon plasma is considered to live in n equals 4, not QCD.
Sure, that's right. So the real QCD will go beyond, again, the CFT. It will be more like this gauge gravity duality rather than the ADS CFT duality, right? So, but statement it, still it's remarkable that you get something like whatever is basically measured, right? And so, okay, so I have maybe 5 minutes to tell you how to calculate your tutorial, the second part of your tutorial today. And so let me just introduce a few notions. So really, in order to do this calculation, you need to understand relativistic hydrodynamics. Okay, so let me just say relativistic hydrodynamics, and it will be just one hydrodynamics. And so basically, what hydrodynamics means is that you are taking some effective field theory for your description. And typically, what hydrodynamics means is that everything is very slowly varying. Okay, so you don't have perfect equilibrium situation everywhere, but you have local equilibrium situation. Right? So locally, it looks like equilibrium. But when I move, suddenly I find, well, my temperature slightly changed. So I have sort of local equilibrium, but the temperature can change from place to place. The velocity can be, you know, the things can be slowly moving and stuff like that. So we have local equilibrium, but this slowly varies from place to place. That's what hydrodynamics description is good for, place to place. So you can imagine that, you know, things are very, very slowly varying, but locally, when I zoom on this thing here, it will be in equilibrium here. And so that will happen when, you know, if you can talk about things like mean feed paths of interactions of particles and stuff like that. This must be the characteristic scale, so lambda mean free path, mean free path. So that must be much, much smaller than lambda of fluctuations. Okay, so the fluctuations are really, really big. And so this description will be good if you have like low energy fluctuations and super, super long range fluctuations. So if you describe this in the Fourier space, it means the momentum goes to zero and the frequency of the fluctuations goes to zero. Okay, so now how is this described? And the statement is, well, I have my hydrodynamic fluid. I describe it by corresponding energy momentum tensor, T mu nu. Okay, and I know that my T mu nu better be conserved. Okay, so described by the conservation of the energy momentum tensor, describing my fluid. In the first approximation, the T mu nu will be that of perfect fluid, but there will be some corrections. Okay. But now look at this thing here. How many equations I have if I am in d dimensions? So this is d equations of motion. How many entries for T mu nu I have in general?
Plus d.
So this is a symmetric tensor, so it's d times d plus 1 over 2. So T mu nu, however, has d times d plus 1 over 2 components. So I cannot definitely determine the full T mu nu out of these equations of motion, right? What you have to do is that you have to kill the degrees of freedom of T mu nu so that you have only d independent components of that. This is done in terms of the constitutive relations. Okay, so to reduce the number of components of T mu nu, you introduce constitutive relations, which tells me constitutive relations, which tell me, okay, not all of my d times d plus 1 components are independent, but only d of them are independent. Okay, let's take d independent components to be something which describes my hydro. Temperature is one of them. T of x, right? Locally, it will be just t, but if I move very, very far away, it will be t of x. So that's one component. And the velocity of the fluid, why not? U mu of x. Okay, so this will be d independent components, which I'll be solving for these equations for, right? And is this really d? This is a 1. It seems like d. It seems like d plus 1. Is that d plus 1? U square is minus 1. So there's really d components here. Okay, so really what you want to do is that you want to prescribe these things here. So these are your independent variables. You'll be solving for them by these equations of motion. But I have to express everything else in T mu nu in terms of these components here. This is given by the constitutive relations. These constitutive relations will have some undetermined coefficients in them. These coefficients will be called transport coefficients. Okay, one of them is the shear viscosity. These transport coefficients is something which is given to you by God in this hydrodynamic description. However, if you know microscopic physics, if you know what the actual atoms are doing and stuff like that, you can determine what these transport coefficients are. Okay, so these constitutive fields depend on depend on transport coefficients, one of which is, for example, the Xi viscosity. So now, how do you deal with this T mu? The T mu to the first approximation will be T mu of perfect fluid. Okay. What will be the next approximation? Well, something where I can, which has, you know, which will be dying off quickly. You are doing an expansion in something so that the next term is always smaller than another term. What is a small number here? Lambda mean field path divided by lambda fluctuation. It's a small number. If I make sure that the first correction to my perfect fluid thing is of that order, lambda mean field path divided by lambda fluctuations, then I have well-convergent series. And that will be another power of this ratio and so on. What that right expansion you should be doing here is so-called derivative expansion. If things are very moving slowly here, then if you start taking derivatives, it will be even more slowly moving. Okay, so the right thing is to do derivative expansion, and that's what you will do in your tutorial. You will see that in the first order correction to the perfect fluid, there is something which you will study in your tutorial, and then we will return back to that in Monday's lecture. So let me stop here. Questions? So what we will be doing is the derivative expansion of this, and you will study the first order correction in derivative expansion. So you will be putting some derivatives on this thing here. That's how your correction to T mu looks like. Okay? Yes?
Where do the constitutive relations come from?
Very good. So they sort of are, you are in the effective field theory. So you, what you want to do is that you want to write down sort of like all the terms which are consistent with your symmetries and stuff like that. And you are doing that in the derivative expansion. And so you are evaluating everything in terms of these, you know, known quantity, well, in terms of these D quantities. But there are some guiding principles how to do that. So it may not be completely unique. It depends on the choice of, you know, yeah. But there are some rules which you have to follow. Typically, one of the rules is that you want, for example, the second law of thermodynamics is preserved. You want that, you know, whatever happens, the entropy has to always increase in your fluid. Okay, so that's one of the relations. But I'm not doing. I'll do it on Monday. Okay, I'll do it on Monday. Okay, tutorial will be. Now you have something to. At least you have a vague idea what you are doing in the tutorial. Okay.